In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome to another edition and another year of iSpy Radio, helping you to get a little more intelligence on big government. If this is your first time joining us, a special welcome to you as we kick off a new year. We hope you'll join us every week as we give you more intelligence in 1 hour than most shows do in three. You know, consumer and small business optimism are both at an all-time high as we enter the new year. And we have some good news about what can happen if you use common sense approaches to the environment and harvesting natural resources. Thanks to the Trump administration, could the extreme environmentalists, which ran the Obama administration, which made industry beg to access any natural resources, which wanted to regulate every drop of water in the United States, and which tried to keep the public off of public lands, could the extreme environmentalists finally be on the retreat? Stay tuned for that as we talk with Mike Heatwall of the Pebble Mine. But first up, hope of another kind. I'd like to welcome now Jeff Jimerson. He is the founder and director of Oregon Life United, and he is the chief petitioner for the 2018 ballot initiative to stop taxpayer-funded abortion in Oregon. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your organization, Oregon Life United?
Yeah, we are a pro-life organization, and it's a pretty we have a pretty tightly defined mission, and that is simply to pass our state's first ever pro-life law. So for listeners who maybe don't define pro-life in the same way I do, the way we define pro-life is a law that would protect mothers and babies from abortion. So Oregon has no state laws whatsoever to reduce abortion, to limit abortion, and our aim is to get a law passed that protects these moms and babies from being harmed by abortion.
Well, especially in terms of this notion that even if you're a pro-life taxpayer here in Oregon, you're being forced to pay for these abortions because of the new laws that Oregon passed this last year. We've said now, let me back up a little bit. When you tell people that, that Oregon is now the only state in the nation with zero pro-life laws to protect the unborn, no parental notifications, no limits on when an abortion can be done, right up to 9 months, I mean, are people shocked when you tell them that, that we have no pro-life laws whatsoever?
Yeah, people are shocked. And, you know, when we started these ballot initiatives, we've been working on this for about 7 years now. And when we first started this to stop taxpayer funding abortion, people didn't even believe that they were paying for abortions because it had been going on for so long. It's been the state of Oregon's had unrestricted public funding for abortion since 1984. And when I found out about that, I wanted to do something about it. So got the ballot initiative started telling people about it. And they flat out told me I was lying, that this wasn't happening. Wow. And so over the course of the last several years, we've been able to really educate just tens of thousands of Oregonian voters that, yes, our tax dollars are being used to pay for abortions. And now, as you mentioned, with the new House Bill 3391, we're paying for even more abortions. So, yeah, people are shocked when they find out how sort of low we are in the state. And it's really time we do something about it.
I know that when I've talked to people, what they tend to be most shocked about is this notion that you can abort a baby right up to 9 months. And I think that grabs a lot of people, even people that are so-called pro-abortion. I think that shocks them to think that you can have a baby that's full term and you can still abort it here within Oregon.
Yeah, the one thing there is there probably isn't any doctors in Oregon that will do that, but there certainly isn't any restrictions against it. Oregon is governed only by federal law when it comes to abortion, and federal law says you can have an abortion for any reason. You can have an abortion up to term if it protects the health of the mother. And the health, of course, is loosely defined. It could even be mental health.
Yeah.
So there aren't, to my knowledge, any doctors who do abortions up to 9 months. But as we as we alluded to, you know, it's certainly not, there's nothing in the books that says you can't do that.
Wow. So this Monday, the United States Supreme Court decided not to review a Mississippi religious freedom law, meaning that no government bureaucrats or other officials cannot force people with faith-driven objections to same-sex marriage to act against their own beliefs, at least for now. Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant praised that decision, saying this law was democratically enacted and is perfectly constitutional. The people of Mississippi have the right to ensure that all of our citizens are free to peacefully live and work without fear of being punished for their sincerely held religious beliefs. And we'll link up that article on iSpyRadio.com if you haven't heard that. But could that decision impact a state like Oregon that forces taxpayers to pay for abortions? I mean, could that open the door to lawsuits here in Oregon on behalf of pro-life taxpayers who don't want to be forced to pay for abortions?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly could. The problem is, in Oregon, the reason we're paying for abortions goes back to an Oregon Supreme Court decision. So, you know, if that case is going to be argued in the state of Oregon, then it's going to go to the Oregon Supreme Court. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of friends there. So, you know, whether that could be argued on a federal level, you know, maybe so. And that's certainly a promising case that you just mentioned in Mississippi.
Well, certainly with Gorsuch appointed, I think that keeps the conservative side of the Supreme Court intact. And who knows, we may get one or two more before Trump is done. Let's go and take a break. Coming up, we'll talk about their ballot initiative and their upcoming event with Mike Huckabee, times, details, and locations. We are talking with Jeff Jemerson, founder and director of Oregon Life United. You can visit them at OregonLifeUnited.org. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talk today to Jeff Jemerson. He is the founder and director of Oregon Life United and the chief petitioner for the 2018 ballot initiative to stop taxpayer-funded abortions here in Oregon. So talk to us a little bit about that initiative. What exactly does it seek to do?
It's pretty simple, actually. It stops the flow of Oregon state tax dollars from being used for abortions. Currently, there are no restrictions or limitations of any kind. Meaning, if someone is on the Oregon Health Plan, they can have as many free abortions as they want. There are no limits or restrictions. And so we think that taxpayers shouldn't be forced to pay for abortions, healthy babies, at any term, any time during pregnancy. This is just frankly wrong. And now with the new House Bill 3391, free abortions are being offered to undocumented immigrants. Free abortions are being offered to customers of Providence Health Plans. Providence won't cover abortion. They're a pro-life organization. So now the state says, well, that's okay. We'll just give free abortions to your customers through the Oregon Health Plan.
So let me give you a scenario. If, say, somebody that doesn't have insurance or maybe doesn't want to have their insurance pay for it lives in Idaho or Washington or California, can they cross the border, come over here, and get a free abortion?
I don't see any reason why they wouldn't be able to. If you're an undocumented immigrant with no paperwork proving that you're legally in the United States and you can get a free abortion in Oregon, I don't see why someone from Idaho or California couldn't do the same.
Wow. So how many signatures do you need and how many do you have so far?
Well, we need 117,000 plus a little valid signatures. And our goal is a little bit more than that. We're actually shooting for 150,000 because the elections office likes to throw away signatures for a variety of reasons. So we need to give ourselves a good cushion. So we're shooting for 150. Right now in our hands, we have about 92,000. So the deadline is still several months away. We've got time. We just need to activate the community, the pro-life community, the church in Oregon to get behind this. We need more churches, we need more volunteers, and we're confident we can get it done. We just need to take advantage of the time that we have.
Now, your website is OregonLifeUnited.org, but you guys also have another website, StopTheFunding.org, and you have made this tremendously easy for anybody that wants to either just sign the petition themselves. It's a single signature. You just download the form, sign it, send it in. But you also have multiple signature sheets for somebody that maybe wants to take this to their church or just their family and friends in the neighborhood, people that they know are pro-life and would want to sign this. And all of that is just easily downloadable right there on StopTheFunding.org, correct?
Yeah, the single signature sheet is downloadable. We do mail the 10-line sheets.
Okay.
So we send those out about 3 times a week. Really easy, like you said. There's actually another cool tool we added recently to the website. A lot of people aren't sure if they've signed this petition or not. It's been out for a few months. So you can go to stopthefunding.org and click on the link that says, "Have I signed yet?" And then just type in your name. First and last name is all you need. And we'll tell you if you've signed this petition or not.
Well, that's cool. So to help with this initiative, you have Mike Huckabee coming to Oregon. He's going to be coming out the weekend of the he'll be coming out Sunday, the 21st and the 22nd. That's Sunday and Monday. And he's going to be at the Red Lion in Jansen Beach up in Portland. That's Sunday, January 21st from 2 to 4. He'll then be down in Salem at the People's Church, which is out on Lancaster Drive, Northeast, from 7 to 9 p.m. Sunday night. And then on Monday night, January 22nd, he'll be at the Bethel Church on Vista Point Road in Medford, also from 7 to 9. What can people expect at these events?
Well, we're going to have a whole panel of speakers. We're going to be talking about what Oregon is currently facing in terms of the sort of wide open policy with free abortions. We're going to have local legislators speaking. We're going to have directors of pro-life ministry speaking. And then, of course, Mike Huckabee is going to be there to bring the keynote. And then I'll be speaking about the ballot initiative, talking about how folks can get involved and support this over the next few months.
And people do need tickets for that. I assume they can buy those at the door, but I know for sure that they can get them right now online just by heading to OregonLifeUnited.org. And at the top of the page, just look for Speak Life 18. It's $20 to get in the door. Is that correct?
That is. And I actually have a coupon I can give you for your listeners.
Great.
To save $5 a ticket. If any listener types in I Spy Radio into the discount code, they can get those tickets for $15 a piece.
Great. We like that. And so I was looking at the information sheet for that event, and one of the things that really jumped out at me is this. You're going to have powerful testimony from women who've had abortions and how they've sought forgiveness and healing. I have to imagine that would be tremendously moving for people to hear those testimonials.
Yeah, we've got it's going to be a moving evening and afternoon, depending on which one you go to. A full program where our goal is to equip people, to encourage people, and to really enable people to be better ambassadors for the pro-life movement. Education, resources, real practical things that we can do right now to make a difference in this state.
Well, I noticed that in Planned Parenthood's list of services for women, they never list psychological or spiritual services on coping with killing your child. I mean, that's just something you never hear from Planned Parenthood, is the devastation that a lot of these women go through having had an abortion.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I've been involved in pro-life work for about 20 years, and I've found there's really two types of women who have had abortions. And one type is the woman who really regrets it deeply, and they realize they've done something that they shouldn't have done. And many of those women carry that grief for their entire lives, really devastated through that experience. And then the other type, the other response, is women who become hardened through that experience. And sadly, I think that's many of the women who would claim to be pro-choice, who maybe would support groups like Planned Parenthood. They essentially have become hardened, and it's very sad. And I do believe that the ministry of serving women through pro-life work is really about protecting them from making decisions that is going to harm them from the rest of their lives, spiritually, physically, emotionally.
Absolutely, yeah. All right. Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for your time. Details of the Mike Huckabee event can be found on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com and on their site, OregonLifeUnited.org. Jeff, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Speak Life 2018 will be held in Portland, Salem, and Medford on January 21st and 22nd. Come hear Mike Huckabee, the keynote speaker at all three events. Oregon is the only state with no pro-life laws. Be there as Oregon Life United shares their vision for how we can change this in 2018. Come to be encouraged, better equipped, and inspired by powerful testimony. Visit OregonLifeUnited.org for details and to order tickets. Use the discount code iSpyRadio, all one word, and save $5 per ticket. OregonLifeUnited.org. SpeakLife 2018 will be held in Portland, Salem, and Medford on January 21st and 22nd. Come hear Mike Huckabee, the keynote speaker at all three events. Oregon is the only state with no pro-life laws. Be there as Oregon Life United shares their vision for how we can change this in 2018. Come to be encouraged, better equipped, and inspired by powerful testimony. Visit OregonLifeUnited.org for details and to order tickets. Use the discount code iSpyRadio, all one word, and save $5 per ticket. OregonLifeUnited.org. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're joined now by Mike Heatwohl. He is the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pebble Partnership, commonly known as the Pebble Mine, which is looking to retrieve a huge mineral deposit of copper, gold, and molybdenum near the Bristol Bay Air region of southwest Alaska. Mike, it's good to talk to you guys.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, and it's especially good to talk to you because it seems like when we've talked to you in the past or somebody from the Pebble Mine, it's been bad news, but you guys actually have good news for a change. But let's talk a little bit about the Pebble Mine project itself. You guys broke into the news initially not because of the tremendous amount of gold, copper, and other minerals that could be mined, which really ought to have been the focus of the news, but because the EPA and environmental groups had really conspired to block you from even applying for a permit to mine. Remind our audience just how much gold, copper, and other minerals are we talking about?
It's a significant volume of copper, gold, and molybdenum. Estimates are the in the entire deposit of approximately 100 million ounces of gold, several billion pounds of copper, and billions of pounds of molybdenum. This is a world-class mineral discovery for Alaska and, frankly, for the world. Yeah, so 80 billion pounds of copper, 5.5 billion pounds of molybdenum, and 107 million ounces of gold.
And that's an astonishing amount of minerals there. But it's not just the value that is within that gold and copper and everything else, but it's also the number of jobs that you can be creating there as well.
Yeah, it's jobs and economic activity, very significant. Our current proposal for a 20-year mine life at the project, we'd employ about 2,000 Alaskans, and there would be definitely reciprocal jobs generated in other parts of the United States as we acquire the the goods that are necessary, the supplies that are necessary to run a mining operation. Just one small example. You know, in order to crush the rock down to the consistency of talcum powder so that we can process the minerals from that rock, we need steel balls of varying sizes, and they're going to have to come from somewhere. And so I'm sure there's a supplier in the United States that would be happy to provide us with that. And, of course, that's going to employ that operation for a time to come. So we don't have the numbers on in terms of jobs in the rest of the country, other than saying we know there will be a positive impact.
Well, and of course, the other exciting thing about this, too, is not just the jobs there and, as you mentioned, the equipment, but also the research possibilities. I mean, you know, whenever you have a project like this, you get people coming in and saying, hey, you know, a better way to do this would be to do this. And I think that's the other exciting thing is not just a massive amount of equipment buys, but also the likely new types of equipment that could be created out of this.
No, absolutely. It seems every 5 to 10 years, there are very significant changes across industries. You know, as we learn more about water management and impacts on water tables and things of that nature, as that science changes and we can adopt great information from that, it's very, very exciting. Same goes for the process of extracting those minerals from the rock. Continuous improvement there. It's you're correct. A lot of exciting potential across the spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, you guys really made the news because the EPA blocked you guys from even applying for your permit. As part of that, you also uncovered that the EPA was working with and coordinating with environmental groups that were also trying to block this. Is the new EPA chief working to distance the EPA from those outside groups? Because the EPA should be objective here and not in the business of political activism.
No, that's that is exactly correct. So we're very excited when President Trump selected the Attorney General of Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, to head the EPA. because of his commitment to what he calls the rule of law. Administrator Pruitt has made it very clear that he wants to return the agency to just that, and that's operating from the middle of the spectrum, not pro-development to the nth degree and not pro-environment to the nth degree, but rather we have regulations and rules on the books that should be followed. And that's just refreshing from an industry perspective to hear that.
Mm. So where do things stand now with the Pebble Mine? I believe you have your applications in?
Yep. So 2017 was very exciting for us. We had three key objectives going into the year. One was to secure an agreement with the EPA that we would be allowed to get into that permitting process. The second was to bring on board a new partner for the project, and we announced that in the middle of December, that First Quantum Minerals, a major copper-producing company, had expressed an interest in joining us. And then the last was to file for our permits, and we did that on the 22nd of December, so we made all three of our key objectives. And
wow.
Then learned here last week that the Corps of Engineers had accepted our application, and we are now officially in the permitting and review process for our project. It's a great day for us.
That is absolutely exciting. You know, we've been following you guys for a number of years, and so that is, we're just tickled to death for you that you're finally now able to get at least to that stage. So how long before you were able to even begin to break ground?
Yeah, that's a great question for us. So we estimate 3 to 5 years for permitting, and of course we'd prefer it to be closer to the three-year marker. One of the interesting things about the U.S. permitting regime is that there's no time clock once you start the permitting process.
Wow.
We certainly hope to have it as expeditious as possible, but you want to make sure that all the I's are dotted and T's crossed so that you can survive litigation that usually comes in situations like this. And so it is a lengthy process, but it's dictated by the agencies, and we have had very constructive conversations with the Corps of Engineers that realizes that they can do better in terms of schedule delivery, and they're so far meeting those commitments.
Well, we will certainly keep our fingers crossed for you. I know that when it came to things like infrastructure, Trump has said that the current permitting process is 10 years, but he'd really want to get that down to 2 years. So hopefully he can do something like that for you guys as well. Let's go ahead and take a break. Coming back, we'll be talking more about the Pebble Mine and also the impact of the whole mine on the environment. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking all about natural resources on today's show. We're doing that with Mike Heatwold. He is the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pebble Partnership, commonly known as the Pebble Mine. They are looking to extract a huge amount of minerals of copper, gold, and molybdenum up near the Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska. And if you think of Alaska, it has that long tail there. That's sort of that, well, we'll call it the armpit, I guess, right in that nook there. If you're not terribly familiar with that. And so, of course, this is raising a lot of concerns because Bristol Bay is a favorite of fishermen. It has a lot of fish. And so the question becomes, how do you get all of those minerals out without damaging the environment? And I know that is a major concern for the governor there. How do you even address how do you address getting all of those minerals out without having that massive impact that people are worried about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to begin with, that's first and foremost why we wanted to get into the permitting and review process. We have spent a tremendous amount of money and staff time to know as much as we can about the environment, the ecology around us, a lot of data in terms of water quality, stream flows, groundwater flows, wanting to know everything we can about water, fish, and wildlife around us so that we can design a plan that meets all of the regulatory requirements for development and meets our corporate imperative to not impact the productivity of that fishery. We recognize the critical importance that salmon has to southwest Alaska culturally and commercially. And that's where we begin. And we believe that we can do it, meet the standards that Alaska and the nation has for development, and be able to demonstrate that. But we need to have a third-party review by the government agencies to look at all of our assumptions and be able to tell concerned stakeholders that, yes, everything that they're talking about here either meets the requirements or it doesn't. And that's why we have a regulatory process to follow.
Now, some of the early write-ups about the Pebble Mine, they were saying that this is going to be roughly the size of the Grand Canyon by the time you start pulling all of those things out. I know that's not anywhere near that, but it is a significant amount that you guys are talking about. I think it's around 5.5 square miles. Is that correct?
That's where we do a like-for-like comparison with how the EPA was characterizing the project. We come in now at about 10.7 square miles, which is actually a reduction from what we talked about here just 3 months ago. And to put it in context in terms of footprint and size and all of that, people's eyes kind of glaze over sometimes when you start talking about numbers. And so the Bristol Bay region of Alaska is roughly the size of the state of Ohio. And what we're talking about is really the construction of a large airport facility within the state of Ohio in terms of the footprint. And our job is to, you know, manage our operations so that we don't impact the environment outside of the borders of our development. Because, you know, if you dig a hole and you're moving material around, you're going to have a localized impact. But the job is to ensure that the fish and water resources that people in the area depend upon remain sound.
Now, in terms of that footprint, the 13 square miles or so, that's the entire operation, right? That's not just the mine?
No, correct. So when you talk about the pit and our tailing storage facility, that's where you get at about 5.4 to 5.9 square miles. But when you include a power plant, a water treatment facility, housing for our workforce, the process facility, you know, where we crushed the rock down to that talcum powder that I was mentioning earlier, the roads associated with that, some water storage areas, and just a whole host of all the infrastructure that's required, that footprint's about 10.7 square miles. And that's what I was trying to compare to context for the state of Ohio.
Well, and so obviously that's a very small size there, but that's the cleverness of the extreme environmentalists, because when they hear the size of the Grand Canyon, not only is that a massive amount, but then it creates that mental picture that here we've got
Correct.
This pristine area and suddenly it's denuded to end up looking like the Grand Canyon. All of the trees are gone. Everything's just it's just bare as a bone.
Yeah, Alaska's challenge is that we are blessed as a state with a pretty amazing environment around us, but we're also a huge state. You were talking earlier about just the size of our state. If the northern point of Alaska, if you overlay us on the continental United States, the northern point of our state would basically touch the Canadian border, and then the eastern side of Alaska would run down to the Panhandle in Florida, and the Aleutian chain would stretch all the way to California.
Wow.
If you cut us in half, we're still going to be the two biggest states in the union. We have one of the smallest populations, and you know, we need resource development done responsibly in order to have an economy. In fact, one of the arguments against Alaska becoming a state in 1959 was that with such a small population base, the nation was worried that we would not be able to sustain ourselves. And so of that 365 million acres, they gave the state title to 105 million acres, of which the land that Pebble sits upon belongs to the state of Alaska, and it's open to mineral exploration. It's one of the ironies in this entire debate.
Well, and I think that's the thing is, you know, we need to have natural resources. It's not like you can go through life and not tap into some sort of natural resources, whether it's like here in Oregon. It's the timber industry, or up in Alaska, these minerals, or you know, out east there where they have the oil and exploration. Of course, you guys have that too. We need to be able to access those natural resources. And there was a great article in the Washington Post, which of course had immediately trotted out the same talking points from 40 years ago when Trump announced that he wanted to open up Alaska's National Wildlife Refuge. And your senator, Sam Sullivan, replied with, quote, "The fundamental disconnect in this debate about developing ANWR's coastal plain, mirrored in the Post editorial, is that the debate has not kept up with Alaska's world-class environmental standards or advancements in technology." And I think that's really the key that's been missing in so much of this natural resource debate, is that the technology has improved so much, and people are far more responsive to environmental concerns. We have a friend here that says in the timber industry, we use everything now except for the shade. And I think, but people have that old picture of that cartoon where a giant redwood is shaved down to produce a single toothpick. And I think they also think of mining as incredibly destructive. Talk to us a little bit about some of the improvements in mining that you guys have seen.
one of the big improvements is just the deployment of technology across the spectrum. It's greater understanding about the environment around us. You look at water, for example, and just the enormous changes that have been made in our knowledge about how water works. And we have hired some of the premier experts in the field of hydrology to help us design the most responsible project here. And that's just one of many areas. Another is using technology to maximize how you determine how to mine the resource, and so that you're not expending extra energy, getting more rock than you need to when you go into the operation. And I would say that one of the most important improvements across the spectrum for the mining industry is both the commitment to worker safety and environmental responsibility. And those are two obviously very critical aspects of any operation. Yeah. But if you look at the track record across the U.S. industry for mining in the last 40 years, it's a very successful one, especially here in the last 25 years, which is Alaska's most immediate experience with hard rock mining.
Yeah, absolutely. And ironically enough, it makes the environmental movement out of touch with reality. Let's go and take a break there. Coming back, we'll continue our discussion about natural resources with Mike Heatwell of the Pebble Mine. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show, talking today about natural resources, and we're doing that with Mike Heatwell. He is the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pebble Partnership, commonly known as the Pebble Mine. And, we were talking about natural resources and extraction here, and especially a lot of the improvements within extraction, whether it's timber or minerals, oil and so forth. And I think by not doing it here in the U.S. and by not allowing this harvesting of natural resources, what that inevitably does is it means you're driving that development offshore. I mean, how responsible really is China or Russians when it comes to the environment? I mean, ironically, the political and environmental left, by shutting down natural resources, I mean, they're enriching the Russians.
Yeah, one of the great ironies that I always have a little chuckle to myself is the outrage that some express about our project, and they're using a computer or a smartphone to tell their concern to the rest of the world, not even realizing that the smartphone they're using uses 62 minerals that had to come from mineral development somewhere.
Yes.
And the electricity comes from a cord that is using copper, and that of course the energy is produced by our colleagues in the energy industry, and it's very ironic that we as a society have a demand for the products that the miners are going out to bring forward, and copper of course is integral in the economy of today. In fact, as you probably know, miners are the big proponents of green energy, because if you want an electric car, that's 300 pounds of copper. Your wind turbine requires 3,000 pounds of copper, and your solar panel, 60% copper. If you want to have renewable technologies, it requires minerals in order to make it successful.
Absolutely.
And we're either going to mine it here in the United States under the highest environmental standards, or we're going to turn a blind eye and bring it from somewhere else.
Of course, there's still a lot of people that are opposed to your development there, and Trump has said that he would like to have more local control over public lands. So what do the local people think of the Pebble Mine project, and how do you go about winning them over?
Mm-hmm. It's a two-part answer. Those who are in the communities closest to us and closest to the prospect, and people who we've been working with now for 10 to 15 years or more in terms of our exploration work, have a very different view about our project than those who are 100 miles away and really look to the project as all risk and no reward. And so one of the things that we've done while we were battling the EPA was taking a hard look at our project and saying, how can we work to really make sure that people who have expressed a lot of opposition can be more comfortable with our design. And so we've brought forward a smaller mine plan with a lot of enhancements on the environmental safeguard front. But we also took a look and said, can we achieve a level of local participation in sharing of the opportunity beyond jobs and beyond the economic activity? And so one aspect of our plan is to create an entity within the Southwest region where locals will get a 5% interest in our project that will result in an annual dividend from a successful operation. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of many things we've done to really acknowledge that people who have concerns and question about what's in it for them, that we can answer it with a lot more than just the job opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, the other problem is you're not dealing just with people within that immediate area, which ought to have the highest say in it. But I remember years ago when we were dealing with the removal of the potential removal of some hydroelectric dams in the Klamath Basin, they were not only dealing with the local people, but the EPA, or actually it was the Department of Interior, was sending out these surveys across the nation asking other people. I mean, like, I know that a big bunch of them went to Ohio and other places asking, well, should we be pulling out these dams in the Klamath Basin? A lot of these people didn't even know where the Klamath Basin was, and yet their survey responses counted every bit as much as people there within Oregon and California. So how do you then deal with people that aren't even anywhere near there and yet claim to have some sort of vested interest in your project?
Yeah, that's a tough one because, you know, there is a perception, I think, from some folks within the continental U.S. that we're actually mining out in Bristol Bay, and of course we're 100 miles away. One of the things that is important, I think, in a public comment process is quantity versus quality versus quantity, right? And so that if you receive 100,000 comments that say the exact same thing, you know, really that ought to be counted as just one, because there's nothing new being presented, and it's not a constructive comment to the actual project that's in front of us. You know, one of the challenges, of course, we face as a society right now is all of this click-through technology and public comment things are really ripe for manipulation. So, you know, here, win a trip to Alaska by submitting your comment and join hundreds of thousands of others. And, you know, whose voice does matter the most in a public comment capacity? You know, somebody in Ohio or somebody who lives in Illiamna or Non-Dalton, which are 12 miles away from the project.
Right. Well, I think, looking ahead here, I think we're going to have to definitely reexamine how the EPA and other government entities really interact with some of these nonprofits, because, you know, they're pushing political agendas rather than allowing for natural resource extraction. And I think they're hurting the process much more so than helping it. Because as you said, I mean, if you're in the green energy movement, you need these minerals. Well, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to offer that, you know, in working with environmental organizations, I sure would like to meet with environmental groups who are more, you know, kind of in the middle of the conversations, yes. Right? Hold industry accountable for living up to the laws that we have in our states and in our nation for environmental performance. And when industry is doing it right, stand up beside and with them and say, you know, these guys are meeting the standards, but of course that interferes with the fundraising opportunity because you need boogeymen, mineral development or logging operations or oil and gas plays in order to raise money to keep the doors open, because it's not a successful financial model to go out and say, yes, these industry guys, they know what they're doing, they take it seriously, they put a lot of science behind what they're up to, and they're okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll wrap things up and talk about the EPA, enemy or ally. And welcome back in our final segment with Mike Heatwohl. He is the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pebble Partnership, commonly known as the Pebble Mine. And, you know, going on to that last segment there, we were talking about it would be nice for you guys to be able to work with these common sense environmental groups. And I think that's absolutely right. You know, I have always taken the approach when it comes to the environment. It was a saying that my dad used to have whenever we went camping, is that leave it as good or better than when you found it. And I think that's the thing. It's not that the environment shouldn't be touched, but that you go in, harvest the resources. If it's trees, you replant them. If it's the mine, you fill it back in and bring it back to nature. And I think that ought to be the approach of these environmental groups. But unfortunately, so many of the ones that you're faced with, it's hands off, don't use it.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And, you know, I think it is important to have voices within the public discussion to hold industry accountable and ask hard questions, but at the end of the day to recognize where things are being done right, to be able to step up and say, you know, this is a good operator, they're meeting the requirements, and we're okay with it because we recognize that the product that they're bringing to consumers and is so important.
Absolutely. You know, one of our previous guests from Pebble Mine, John Shively, had said that he thought that the mindset at the EPA, the then EPA, under the Obama administration, really needed to change because he said that he had hoped the EPA could be an ally in this rather than an opponent. Mm-hmm. And shouldn't that really be the role of any government agency, more like a concierge? You know, how can we help you do what you want to do, and how can we help you navigate within the laws and be successful? Are you seeing any of that with the new Trump EPA, that they're less combative and more of an ally when it comes to natural resources?
That certainly remains our hope. We've seen an attitude change, and hopefully that will work its way down to the line worker. I do think that there are pockets of excellence within all of our agencies. You know, folks who take the role seriously, but also recognize that it's all about balance, and it's about working with you and not trying to block you, getting to yes, and not just saying no. You know, in the United States, we set laws and we have standards that have to be met. And as an applicant, the question becomes, can you meet the standard or not? And if you can't meet the standard, you shouldn't get a permit. But if you can meet the standard and the rules of the game that have been set by the regulators, you should be allowed to go forward.
Yeah.
And not to get into this game of incremental change administratively that goes sometimes many orders of magnitude beyond the original intent of laws as passed by Congress.
Absolutely. You know, I just also, you know, in looking at the EPA, but also these environmental groups, and you know, we always talk about pendulum shifts, you know, or swings, I mean. And it seems like the pendulum has really started to swing against some of these extreme environmentalists on a number of levels. There's an excellent article in Forbes titled "Exxon Prepares to Sue California Cities, Says They Contradict Themselves on Climate Change." And basically what's happening there is that a lot of these cities in California that are at sea level, on the one hand, claim that in their lawsuits against Exxon, this high risk of flooding due to climate change, in some cases, they state it's a 99% chance of flooding due to sea levels rising from climate change. But now Exxon has gone through their bonds and says, you know what, you never actually mentioned any of that when you were issuing these bonds. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. They didn't warn investors about these supposedly extreme flooding risks. You know, and now
you've got, knows no bounds.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got Trump getting out of the Paris Accord. Global warming is continuing to fall into disrepute, and now companies like Exxon suing those cities in California. Are we seeing a real shift in pushing back against the extreme environmentalist movement?
You know, I think as people start to recognize, anytime you have levels of extremism, it presents its own set of challenges. I think most Americans, at least in the circles that I run in, I've got friends who lean left and friends who lean right. It's all about pragmatism and not extremism. And when extremism starts to rule the day, you're right. You'll get a course correction because that's the way our system works. And when you push too far on any end of a spectrum, something's got to give.
Yeah. Well, we've only got about 30 seconds here with you. Real quick, are the extremists digging in and going even further to the extreme, or are they moderating their approaches, you think?
Well, for us, the loudest voices of opposition are continuing to be entrenched, but we're also seeing a lot of movement in our case within the middle, because I think people are recognizing the economic contribution our project could bring to the state.
Well, we certainly hope that common sense will rule. So, Mike, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, we didn't get into it with Mike, but Pebble Mine is looking to form a revenue share program where local residents will get $500 per year and local corporations will get $500,000 annually. Imagine if Oregon did that with timber. Right now, Oregon is going backwards from the rest of the nation. Oregon's going to have to compete now because we won't be able to mask the effect of Oregon's high taxes anymore. So you have a choice. Continue to overtax Oregonians and businesses, or find new revenue streams for the state. Oregon could be the leader in responsible timber harvest. Oregon could be the leader in fire management. Oregon could be opening lands for mineral exploration. There are any number of things we could be doing, but we're not. Instead, we'll have to watch our neighbors prosper. But there is hope, and we'll talk about that next week. Don't forget the Speak Life event. Head to OregonLifeUnited.org for details. Use the discount code iSpyRadio, all one word, to save $5 per ticket. And as always, be sure to visit iSpyRadio.com for links mentioned during today's show, and be sure to share that, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.